The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and New Jersey. Thank you for tuning in to Inside Medicine, our weekly broadcast, 10 a.m. to 11 on 860 The Big Talker. Please note that we have a website that's got 120 podcasts on. If you want to review older shows, www.wwdbam.com, and look for Inside Medicine and then podcast. Today we have a fantastic guest. Dr. Bob Merrill is going to be with us. Bob is a very seasoned practitioner in New Jersey who has a significant practice. He's got a lot of experience, and his basically want to talk about geriatric issues today to help people survive, even pandemics. I do want to say that there is a note that one should always be confident to fearlessly express your potential, i.e. talk up, and that was stated by Penny Kumi from Handsand, co-founder, to improve the health and happiness of the world. My impression is a good explanation of how to get ahead, but make sure that one thing you don't want to do is stand on ladders. Investors Business Daily today had a fantastic article about biotechs taking aim at medical issues fueled by COVID. We have to note that 21 million people in the U.S. have depression. Of those, roughly a third are newly diagnosed with COVID being an etiology. The antidepressant medication is quite good, and as stated in Investors Business Daily, better things are coming. We note that there are SSRIs like Prozac, there's SNAIs like Cymbalta. We have GABA issues, and they can be especially helpful in people with severe depression. There is a medication called Spravato that can be infused over 5 hours if somebody is acutely suicidal. This efficacy is tremendous. The main problem is that its utilization is just not enough. Finally, remember that postpartum depression hits about 1 in 8 women. Medication is highly effective for that. It's generally a 60-hour infusion that is done with significant positivity. So again, it's just not used enough. And when we have a few more antidepressants coming around the corner, as expressed in the biotech article on A7, things are going to get better. Let me now introduce Dr. Bob Merrill. Bob is a fantastic internal medicine type guy who's got a lot of hospital experience, office experience, and he also follows up from his dad, who was a long-term practitioner in the Cherry Hill area. So, Bob, I want to welcome you to Inside Medicine.
Thank you for having me on, Joe. It's a pleasure.
Good. So let me ask you this. What is a geriatrician?
Well, a geriatrician is a physician who's trained in internal medicine or in family practice, who then specializes in treating the elderly. My patients often ask me, what's the difference between a regular internal medicine doctor and a geriatrician? And I tell them that a general internal medicine doctor treats adults. And the idea behind treating the adults is you want to make sure they don't die prematurely of any diseases that they can avoid. So you encourage women to get mammograms done, and people over 50 to get colonoscopies done, and keep their blood pressure and blood sugar under good control. Well, once the patient lives 65 or 70 years, the internal medicine hat kind of comes off and you put the geriatric hat on. Because at the age of 70, you're not dying of anything that's premature. So therefore, now that the goal is maintenance of function so that people who are elderly can live with their spouses and their families in their own homes and not have to be institutionalized or put into a nursing home. And you want to have people functional all the way to the end of their life when they're in their mid-90s and let them pass away.
So Bob, I know 2 years ago I had two patients live over 100 and I was enthralled. the past year, I had two patients die on me at 99 and three-quarter years, and I was so disappointed. So what you're really saying is that there's high capability with proper guidance and, of course, compliance on the patient's sake and a lot of times the patient's family to live those extended years with happiness and fun.
That is correct.
So the geriatrician, so how do you go about your business that makes sure that people max out and live a long time with great health?
Well, it's a matter of staying active. There's a lot of things that you have to do to try to keep people stable. There's always issues with mobility, fall protection so they don't fall in their own home. There is cognitive issues with their deteriorating brain function, incontinence issues, nutrition issues, adequate hydration, and then, of course, all the medications that seniors tend to accumulate over the time as they end up seeing heart doctors and endocrinologists like you, and they end up taking lots of different medications, and you have to make sure you sort all of them out. There is an acute doctor shortage, especially in geriatrics, because of all the people that are living longer. It's one of the fastest rising demographics in the United States is people living past 100. Believe it or not, years ago, if you've lived to 100, you used to get a letter from the President of the United States. And it's growing so fast now that you don't get one. You actually have to request it. You have to request a letter from your congressman so grandma can get a letter from the president congratulating her to be over 100. 16% of the U.S. population now is over 65. And by 2050, which is 28 years from now, 22% of the U.S. population will be over 65. Now, to put that into some context, that's what it is in Florida right now. 22% of the people in Florida are over 65. And Florida is routinely called God's antechamber. So the need for geriatricians and people who are experienced in taking care of seniors is really important. And unfortunately, the number of geriatric doctors is going down, not going up. I guess right now, if you're over 65, people over 65 accumulate 25% of all office visits in the United States to the doctor. And if you get rid of infants, say we're not going to count the infants, it's over 50%. So there's a lot of need for physicians to be able to take care of patients who are elderly and have lots of problems. Over 40% of the hospital stays are people over 65, and they tend to stay in the hospital longer because it takes them longer to get healed from whatever event brought them into the hospital. Their hospital stay tends to be longer. They figure that the doctor shortage is going to be between 40 and 120,000 physicians all over the country. And in 10 years, 40% of all physicians in the United States will be over 65. By state, Pennsylvania has the average highest age of doctors. That's age 57. And in New Jersey is number two at age 56. So the doctors that are hanging around older like you and I.
Watch what you say here, babe. So actually, those numbers are outstanding. I never knew it was data points were available, and as you state, so that means you must be a pretty busy guy. Now, aren't you on the road a lot too?
Well, you have to be on the road a lot because patients go different places. You are people in the hospital, people in your office. When the people leave the hospital, if they're elderly, very often they end up in subacute rehab or what they call post-acute care. And then as they heal and get stronger in the subacute rehabs, they either go home, or if they fail, they have to stay long-term in nursing homes. So you have to kind of go where the patients are, and they can be in a variety of different places.
So that means that your day can start here and go there, then there, and then there. So are there any other geriatricians around besides you? Because you are seem to be the dominant one.
Yeah, there are a few, but it's a field where in year 2000, there were 10,000 geriatricians in the United States. And the field is contracting. Now there's only 7,000. And the estimate that we're going to need another 15,000 by 2030 just to keep up with the demand. And unfortunately, there are plenty of slots in graduate medical education for geriatricians, but only half of them get filled. And it's not a very popular field because the patients are elderly. They're complex. They can be challenging. They often have children that, call the doctor all the time. And there's really not a lot of prestige associated with the field in medical schools and in residency training. Cardiology has a certain cachet, and pulmonology. cardiology and in critical care medicine as a certain cachet, but dealing with the elderly patients who have a variety of problems and medications does not have a lot of cachet.
So more complexity you deal with, and the thing is that it just seems like the voices are not yelling out loud enough at the end of life, because you certainly want to have guys and gals who can take care of complex issues, and that's what usually happens as we get older. How did you end up in geriatrics, by the way?
Well, my father is a family practice doctor in Cherry Hill, and when I got done my chief residency at Cooper Hospital, University Medical Center, in 1983, I joined him in practice, and, at the time, he transferred all of his elderly complex patients to me. So that from almost the beginning, that's all I saw were people who were very, very complex. And I kind of fell in love with the field because the elderly patients have great stories. And if you're bothered to sit down and listen to them, one story that I'd like to tell about 10, 12 years ago, I was rounding at the hospital when the emergency room called me and said there was this 91-year-old gal who lived alone and had fallen, and they wanted me to discharge her home because her x-rays were negative. So I went down to talk to her, and I asked her what her functionality was, and she had her own apartment. She cleaned it. She drove herself to church. She did all of her laundry. She did everything. So I said, well, your x-rays are negative because you fell and hurt your hip. Can you explain to me kind of what happened? And she explained to me that she was walking with her house coat into the bathroom, slipped and fell, and got stuck between the toilet and the tub. She was smart enough to have her cell phone with her in her house coat pocket, called 911. They popped her out, brought her to the hospital, and her x-rays were negative. So I asked her, could somebody pick her up? And she said, no, I really don't have anybody. I said, you don't have any children or grandchildren? And she said, oh, no. She goes, I've been living by myself my entire life. And I said, well, that's incredible. She goes, well, I had a sister, and she died of breast cancer about 10 years ago, but I'm all by myself. I said, you were never married? And she said, well, I was engaged to a captain in the U.S. Navy during World War II. And I have an interest in military history, and I said, was he killed in action? And she said, oh, heavens, no, he served on the presidential yacht. So I said, Franklin Roosevelt's yacht? And she says, oh, yes, I had dinner with the president several times. He would be sitting in his wheelchair. He'd come over and kiss my hand. He was a real charmer. And she was going on and on about her meetings with Franklin Roosevelt. And I'm starting to have the hair on the back of my neck go up because I'm talking to history sitting with this patient. And elderly people have lots of interesting stories like that if you take the time to listen.
That's a great statement, if you take the time to listen. I love it. So there can be some downside to those good stories, because basically when somebody is 95, 99, and 100 plus, I think they may have a need for a death certificate a little bit more than most of the doctors see or experience. So how do you deal with death?
Well, I happen to be a medical director of a hospice. It's called Ascend, A-S-C-E-N-D. And we tell patients very often that when the time comes, we talk to the families, we talk to the patients, that at a certain point, them being comfortable is more important than them living another month or two with a terrible disease. So if we cannot cure and we can't treat them, you want to comfort them and comfort the family. Very often, many of these diseases of the elderly, especially the neurological disorders, are family diseases. Patients who have Parkinson's and had strokes and who have had, Alzheimer's disease, even diseases like MS. As the patient's neurologic situation deteriorates, the families are put under a tremendous amount of stress. And you can't just treat the patient. You have to treat the families as well, because they have to know what to expect and how to adjust to things. I was born and raised in South Philadelphia until I was about 9 or 10 years old. And two doors down from us in a row house in Philadelphia, there was this 83-year-old widow. And she lived by herself in a 3-story row house. And I often wondered how she could do that. And it turned out that her daughter lived two doors down with her husband, and the granddaughter lived at the end of the block with her husband. So if grandmom needed help, there was people around all the time. But with our society now, very often our kids, they go to college someplace away. They may fall in love with somebody far away and end up living in a totally different state and not be around to be able to help their elderly parents. This poses additional challenges as people get more infirm as they get older. Their children may not live close by.
So Bob, you've got an interesting practice. That's all I can say. So again, you know, what illnesses do you see in your senior citizens that the average internist wouldn't see? Is that a fair question or not?
It is. I mean, you see more than your fair share of dementia. Most dementia in the United States, people think of Alzheimer's disease, but the far more common is what they call vascular dementia, which is from hardening of the arteries in your brain, kind of strangling the brain tissue. And this is really, really common. Now, there's not enough, a lot of specific treatment for it because most of the treatment is preventative. If you keep the patient's blood pressure and blood sugar under control and their cholesterol under control, you can kind of prevent that disease from happening across the continuum. But once the patient starts having the cognitive disorders, you know, now the patient needs some help at home and you give them some medication that may be able to stave it off so it doesn't deteriorate further. But there are no real medicines out there to actually to reverse the cognitive impairment.
So I do want to throw one at you because I'm an endocrinologist. How about hypothyroidism? just being the devil's advocate. Patients have hypothyroidism, to be honest with you.
Yes, it's one of those diseases you look for and you're glad when you find it because it may be able to be fixed by supplementing the patient with thyroid hormone. I routinely use a thyroid panel in all my screenings of all my patients just so I could pick it up as early as possible because, again, preventative stuff is a lot better than treating the patient once they get the actual disease.
So, Bob, I want to throw another one at you. What do you think about B12? Because basically the data is 5% of the population is B12 deficient. Do you see much of that?
I see a little of it. I probably have 30 or 40 patients that have true B12 deficiency. Since B vitamins are fortified in almost every food that you can get, this is an absorption problem where the patient can ingest the B12, but it doesn't go into their bloodstream. Very often it has to be injected in. You'll see abnormalities of their nervous system. You'll see abnormalities in their blood. Very often they'll get macrocytic changes on their smear. If you take a look at their blood, you can kind of tell there's something wrong with the blood. And very often B12 will be one of the things that you order. You can treat it and be aggressive with it.
Fantastic, fantastic. So is there any other items that you can see, like a turnaround? I mean, have you seen any other, how about somebody who has AFib? I'm just throwing things out at you. Can you fix AFib, and would that help someone's mental status?
You can fix AFib, and generally the patient will have greater energy. The thing I see in patients with cardiac irregularities like AFib is the patients get very fatigued. Very often, if you get a 35 or 40-year-old who goes into atrial fibrillation, they may not even notice it. But senior citizens really do notice it. The fatigue factor is profound, and a daughter will bring her mother in and say, you know, mom's really tired, a lot more than normal. Just examine her for a minute or two. You can examine her and find out if she's got an irregular heart rhythm and diagnose her as AFib. Now, there are a lot of drugs now to treat AFib, and you can actually convert some of the medications will actually convert the AFib back to a normal rhythm, and the patients will do better. So this is where you know, your buddies, the cardiologists, come into play. But the truth is that many of these disorders can be treated in the office successfully by the patient's own physician and not have to run to the cardiologist.
Gotcha. Now, I got another one to throw at you. How about sleep apnea?
Sleep apnea has become more of a common disorder. We see it across the continuum, young people, middle-aged, and older people, because unfortunately the obesity in the population, sleep apnea is strongly associated with obesity, and they point to if you have a greater than a size 18 neck, it's very, very likely that you have sleep apnea. So we order lots and lots of sleep studies, and if you talk to any of the local pulmonologists, they are inundated with the number of sleep study requests that they have to read and take care of. So this has become a burgeoning field, and sleep medicine now is a recognized part of the pulmonary subspecialty.
So it's always interesting to me because sleep apnea causes a backflow of blood. So a lot of times when someone walks in, like I didn't go for the 18 size neck. I didn't know that was the magic number, but you see edema in their legs because the pressure builds up and they become inefficient. And of course, you ask them how many. Hours they sleep at night, and they say, I don't really sleep at night anymore. And you look at their hematocrit, and you see that it's 52, and the hematologists want to take blood out of them because they're trying to build up their blood to compensate for the lack of oxygen they get while they're sleeping. So I think your statement that there's even now a whole group of doctors who do that is just very interesting, and hopefully people who, anybody out there who listens to you will know, check out that sleep apnea issue.
I often ask patients if they snore, and every patient says, "I don't snore," unless you ask their spouse, and then the spouse will tell them, "Yeah, he snores all night long."
Yeah, I mean, one of the comments that I get frequently is, I ask somebody, you know, if they snore, and they say no, and I say, "Well, if you have a cell phone, could you please call your wife?" "Oh yeah, well, my husband snores so much, I sleep in a different bedroom." So
right, exactly.
You know, it's kind of a funny statement. So if the husband's sleeping in the other bedroom, think about sleep apnea, which you check out strongly. So let me ask you this. Where do you go in your practice? It seems like you're everywhere. Where are the sites that you're seeing making rounds?
Well, I work, obviously, in the office, and that patients come into my office and see me. But we go to Virtua Voorhees Hospital and Virtua Marlton Hospital. We have five physicians and 12 nurse practitioners, and all are really, really dedicated. We go to 10 different subacute facilities, nursing homes, rehabilitation centers, that kind of a thing. And that is actually blooming because more and more people are using these places now. And believe it or not, assisted living centers are becoming a very, very big item for many people. They don't want to continue to live in the big, you know, house that they had before, so they go into an assisted living center where there's a lot of people around that can help them. And very often we will round in assisted living like Brandywine Rehabilitation, where they have a rehab center there, a independent unit, assisted living unit, that kind of thing. And you're seeing more and more of these facilities pop up. Many of them are run by the hotel corporations, Marriott, those kinds of Hilton. And what they have an advantage of is that they don't have to pay a lot for nursing care. These patients are generally either independent living or just a little assisted living, and they need an aid, but they don't really need nursing. And so as a result, they're not as dingy and as difficult as some of the nursing homes are, and patients and their families generally prefer it. So we will actually go to some assisted livings to see the patients there. Very often patients will say, "Well, geez, you know, mom's 85. I mean, how much longer, you know, is she going to have to stay there?" And I quote statistics from the geriatric journals that if you're 85 years old, the average person who's 85 lives 6 more years. And the average person who's 90 lives 4 more years. So it's not like, you know, mom's going to go in there and, you know, she'll pass away pretty soon. It's not necessarily so, especially if they get decent care.
I love that statement, especially if they get decent care. So then where does hospice fit in? Because because you're talking about the overall success rate of longevity is significantly improved, 6 years at 85, 4 years at 90. So where does hospice play in?
Generally, hospice plays a role when the patients become really infirm or start being very uncomfortable with their disease. So you can tolerate COPD or emphysema for a long, long time. But as your lungs deteriorate and everybody's lung function gets worse as they get older, even if your lungs are normal, they get worse as you get older. Patients with emphysema even more so. What happens is that they're gasping for breath and they're having more trouble. And at a certain point, morphine or some other medication may be necessary to ease their work of breathing. And very often this is, again, a family decision where the families all come together and the patient does not want to suffer any longer. And very often it's the patient that has to convince the family that, "Listen, I've had enough. I don't want to end my life, you know, uncomfortable." And we're all about that. We think that is the right way to treat patients. It's in the Hippocratic Oath. If you can't cure them, you comfort them.
I like it. I like it. So what would you say are the biggest challenges that the elderly face?
Well, it's interesting. One of the growing challenges is that if you were to turn the clock back 2 generations ago and go into any nursing home, what you saw was 97% women. Where were the men? They had already passed away. And now we have stents and defibrillators and medications for blood pressure and cholesterol. We can keep people alive a long time living in their own home. And what happens is that you'll have an 87-year-old man with an 85-year-old wife living in home together, and there's nobody else there. And very often the challenge is, how can they function in their own home to make sure they don't trip and fall over something or they don't slip in the bathroom? That kind of thing, it becomes a challenge because now you have one elderly patient taking care of another one in their own home. And very often getting people in to help them out is hard. I tell patients a lot of times that God makes you strong, but only for a while. Everybody needs help at a certain point.
That's quotable. Okay, so that makes a lot of sense to me. So it seems like sometimes that if your spouse sticks around, you can stick around a lot longer too. So it's a good deal for each and everyone to work for the person they married 85 years ago. Sounds like a deal.
It's interesting. There's a lot of data on this, that the best situation for people to live is if you're in a multi-generational house. So if you have a house where there's a mother-in-law suite and the parents live in the suite and the family lives in a house and the children are there, and there's multiple generations there, those patients live the longest with the highest level of quality. And the reverse is if somebody who lives alone in their own apartment, nobody ever stops it, those patients have the worst prognosis and the worst quality. So what we try to do is get family members involved, grandchildren involved, you know, again, make your life rich. It also makes it healthier.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Telehealth has come in over the last few years. Many patients are tickled pink. I think practitioners are tickled pink. You can adjust medicines, do many things over the phone. They get to communicate their issues. You get to size them up from different angles because you do a review of systems. So how about telehealth? How has that changed your practice?
Well, in geriatrics, it's become a significant part of it because a lot of elderly people are immobile. And it was triggered, obviously, by the COVID epidemic where you didn't want patients who were sick with COVID coming in your office and infecting everybody else. So telehealth really started from that, and it has continued onward because, again, if mom is having an issue, they want to get the doctor on the phone right away. And a telehealth visit really helps sometimes in adjusting, say, insulin or adjusting diabetic medications. I'm sure you've had to do this a million times. It's very easy to get somebody on the phone and go over their blood sugars or their blood pressures and say, you know, well, you make an adjustment here, make an adjustment there, and you might be able to intervene and keep them from going to the hospital and, you know, not only saving themselves money, but possibly being, infected by somebody else at the hospital who's sick. So there's a huge emphasis now on trying to keep people out of the hospital, even though the technology is fabulous in the hospital. But there's a lot of sick people in there, and people don't want to go into the hospital and get ill. So doing things from home is a really, really big deal these days.
So what would you say are the frustrations that you see in the geriatric population?
Well, there's challenges for the patients, and there's challenges for the physicians. The challenges for the patients are mobility. As you get older, you get arthritis, and you're a little bit more immobile. Patients, 70% of all falls happen in the bathroom. So when patients take a shower or a bath, you know, very often you have to make sure that the bar in the shower is anchored into the wood, so the patient can use it as a crutch. You have to try to prevent things from happening to patients that can easily be avoided. Hydration is one of them. A lot of, especially the male patients, they generally have this thing, they don't like drinking water. And very often, if you get a little dehydrated and you stand up quickly to go to the bathroom or something, you can get dizzy and you might fall. Prevention of falls is a huge deal for the elderly. The American Geriatric Society has a quote out saying that if you're over the age of 70 and you fall and break your hip, 7 out of 10 of those patients are dead within a year. So prevention of falls is a huge deal. So I spend a lot of my time with my elderly patients, you know, counseling them on how to avoid falls. A lot of them are still living in the same houses that they had when they had kids in the house, and there's three stories, and they have to go upstairs to the bedroom, and the washer and dryer are in the basement, and they're taking steps up and down, and a lot of patients are not really in good shape for that. And as a result, you try to encourage them that maybe, you know, they should move into either an apartment or a bungalow or a one-floor situation so that they decrease the risk of falling.
So, Bob, can you say, do you do many DEXA scans? Maybe you could tell everybody what a DEXA scan is.
A DEXA scan is a test. It's actually a really good test because it requires almost no radiation exposure to the patient. And it measures the densities of the patient's bones. This is acutely a problem for elderly people. Once women go through menopause, the estrogen decreases significantly in their body and their bones become more brittle. And this is one of the reasons that when, you know, senior citizens fall, they don't tend to crack their hip. It shatters like a pane of glass because the bones are so fragile. And doing a DEXA scan gives physicians an opportunity to intervene when the patient is 55, 58, 62, and give them medication to help them build up their bones. You can also encourage them to go through exercise classes, stretching, Pilates, that kind of thing. And all these things help strengthen the patient's bones and decrease the risk of them having a catastrophe if they fall down.
So usually insurers will also, you know, give a DEXA scan every 2 years. So the most important thing is you can calculate how much bone they're losing per year. And if they're losing over 3%, you know that they're in trouble and that they're going to end up not living as long because they'll get taken out by a fall. So in your practice, do you give a lot of Fosamax out or Actonel out? Or once you get that DEXA scan back, how do you respond to some of your patients?
I'm a very big believer in vitamin D because it's got a lot of antiviral properties to it, so it helps with preventing infections like COVID, and it also helps them with absorption of calcium into their bones. For the patients who continue to go downward, you add the Fosamax alendronate to their medical regimen to try to increase the amount of density in their bone. It's a challenge. A lot of the patients don't like taking the medication. A lot of the patients don't like doing the exercises. We want them to get, you know, more involved in exercise. But, you know, for every patient I have that doesn't like to exercise, there's some that end up at the gym at 5:30 in the morning. I call them the dawn patrol people. They go there at the crack of dawn to get their exercise in.
The dawn patrol. I love it.
Yeah.
So you give a lot of vitamin D out, and the goal there is to get their calcium up to at least a 9.6, I'm sure. And the Fosamax, if their bone loss is over 3% per year, they should definitely get treated. Now, I don't think a lot of your people go outside, but have you seen in your practice much Lyme's disease this year?
I have had two patients so far this year with Lyme disease. I'm kind of Lyme disease is a particular fun thing for me because when I was a second-year resident in 1982, I discovered the first case of Lyme disease in the state of New Jersey. It was a week after the New England Journal article came out about what they called Lyme arthritis. It was not called Lyme disease back then. And a guy had come into the emergency room at Cooper where I was a resident, and he had the classic target rash. And the ironic thing was that the next morning we had something called morning report where you talk about the patients that came in the night before. And the head of my department of medicine who was at that report was a guy who trained at Yale. And as you know, Lyme disease is from Lyme, Connecticut, right next to where New Haven is. And all the researchers for Lyme disease were at Yale. He immediately picked up the phone and called Steve Malawista, who was the discoverer of Lyme disease, and brought him down to Cooper for a grand rounds. So it was kind of an interesting thing. So I've always had a particular affinity for Lyme disease, and I check it a lot. It's not nearly as common. A lot of people get tick bites, and they want to be tested for Lyme's. It's interesting that the doxycycline treatment is cheaper than the actual test for the Lyme disease. So very often I just bypass getting the test. And just when somebody comes in with a tick bite, I just give them doxycycline for a week, and that generally takes care of the problem.
That's called being efficient.
Yes.
So considering that you're taking care of the senior citizens a lot, what about how do you treat the hypertensives in your senior citizens? Are there certain medications that you use because they're geriatrics as opposed to, say, somebody who's 30 with new hypertension?
Well, you know, I tend to find that senior citizens get a lot more side effects from medications than people in their 30s and 40s. So I generally go with small doses of the medications and go up very, very slowly. I tend to split medications a lot. I'll give ACE inhibitors in the morning and give them amlodipine at night because the side effect of amlodipine very often is edema, And if you give the patient amlodipine at night, they tend to have much less edema. So I generally give certain medications in the morning, certain medications at night, and I engage the patients and their families in actually helping out. As an endocrinologist, you know, checking your blood sugar at home is a really important thing. And for geriatric patients in my practice, checking their blood pressure at home is a really, really important thing. I have seen a lot of times where a patient will go into a doctor's office and their blood pressure is 160 over 100, and the doctor will, you know, add a significant amount of medication when the patient's blood pressure at home normally is only 126 over 75, but they were just jacked up to see the doctor, or they had coffee that morning, or they were, you know, driving on Route 70 in Cherry Hill, which is aggravating, and so their blood pressure was up in the doctor's office. And the doctor really didn't need to be aggressive with the patient's blood pressure medication. And very often now the patient's blood pressure will be dropped significantly low, and their risk of falling when they stand up to go to the bathroom or they get out of bed early in the morning may be significant. So small changes in the elderly are what you need to do to get them under better control and to keep them safe. Safety becomes a really big thing in the geriatric population.
Well stated. Now, just asking, what about if somebody comes in and has a little bit of angina or, say, CHF symptoms, congestive heart failure symptoms? How do you play that with your patients?
Well, I kind of sit down and talk with them what I think is going on with them and give them, you know, options on how to proceed. Very often, you know, you'll have to arrange for them to be seen. For example, diabetes, when I see a diabetic patient in my practice who's complaining of unusual chest discomfort, very often I will bypass getting the patient a stress test because I automatically assume that they have coronary disease. So therefore, what I'll do is I'll give them a form of nitroglycerin, and I'll also pick up the phone, I'll call the local cardiologist who I know, and I'll say, listen, I need Jim Jones here. He needs a cardiac cath. I don't want him to go into the system and kind of wait to get all the stuff done. I want to get right the information that I need right away. So if my suspicion is high, I'll go right to the cardiac cath and define the anatomy and see if they can't put a stent in or keep the patient from having a heart attack.
Okay, so can you just define a stent for our audience here?
Yeah, a stent is when you have an artery that's clogged or, you know, significantly clogged. It can be in a carotid artery, it can be in your coronary arteries, near your heart. It's a piece of PVC pipe, and that's basically what it is. It's a piece of plastic that they insert in, and they open up the artery, so instead of only 10% of the blood getting through, now 100% of the blood gets through, and the patient's chest pain, angina, congestive heart failure may often be relieved. And it's the most direct way to try to get the answers to the problem is to do the catheterization and at least define what's going on in this patient's anatomy. And then you can completely redesign a medication program once the patient is stabilized to keep them from sliding back, which is the big problem in America, is that patients go into congestive heart failure, they get treated, they get sent home, and the patients by themselves without any help, what happens is that they tend to slide back and they end up in the hospital at a very, very high rate again. They talk about the 30-day readmission rate to the hospitals and how much this is costing Medicare and how much mortality this costs the patient population. To us, being aggressive after the patient is discharged from the hospital, that's when you want to intervene the most. You want to really squeeze them and make sure that the patients understand that this is how we're going to keep you out of the hospital. This is how we're going to keep you alive. So it's kind of counterintuitive. You would think the patient just got out of the hospital. They really don't need to see the doctors. They just got done being seen by a bunch of doctors. And that's the reverse. You have to really be intense treatment after the patient gets out to make sure they don't backslide.
Fantastic, fantastic. So there is one item that I've seen really improved in the senior citizens, and that is aortic stenosis. So in your practice, you hear that systolic murmur. How do you handle that?
Well, the easiest way to handle it is, first of all, you ask them if they're having any symptoms. Obviously, if they're having symptoms where they had an episode where they passed out, or they're having chest pain, or they're having significant shortness of breath, you kind of know that now the murmur is really, really significant, and you got to step on the gas and get this thing addressed. Most of the time, though, it's a function of aging. I tell my patients all the time that aortic stenosis is a disease that I want. And they all look at me quizzically, well, so why would you want that? I said, because you have to live to be 85 plus to get it. So I'd like to be around a while and get my aortic valve all crusted over. An echocardiogram myocardiogram is the easiest test to get because, again, there's no radiation involved in it, and you get a tremendous amount of information from an echocardiogram about how the heart muscle is functioning and how the valves are working and whether the valves are leaking or not. So very often, after you can get an echocardiogram, you can advise the patient whether or not they need to go further and have either a catheterization or the valve replaced, which years ago they used to have to slice open your chest and cut the sternum to get to the valve. But now they go through the groin just like a cardiac catheterization, and it's absolutely incredible. I had a patient 3 months ago. He went in on a Monday morning, had the aortic valve replaced, went home Tuesday morning, and took his wife out to dinner Tuesday night. I mean, it's incredible how rapid these the procedures can be and how healthy the patients come out of them.
So the Tavner procedure was actually done by a doctor at the University of Penn, and hats off to him. And he's put out a lot of people in the area who are excellent cardiovascular surgeons who can reverse and fix that aortic stenosis. So the valve just doesn't open up enough and causes trouble, and they actually crush the valve in place and then put a new valve in place, and usually the patient is done in 20 minutes. And I always tell the story that I had a patient who was 96, and she got turned down at three places for aortic valve. Of course, at that time they were splitting the chest. And she basically went over to Penn, ended up having a cardiovascular surgeon, said, "I'll take care of it." He walks out for the family in the waiting room and says, "I'm Dr. So-and-so, and I'm going to take care of your mom." He goes back out, comes back in 20 minutes, and the patient's family falls apart in the waiting room. They think the mom died because how can anybody get fixed in 20 minutes? And lo and behold, the surgeon's like, no, she's better. She's fixed. So here's technology that, you're going to just melt away because you don't have enough heart pump. Come back in 20 minutes and you're fixed. And it was just a fantastic thing what technology has done. So Bob, I'm sure you have a ton of diabetics. Now, how do you treat your diabetics? Because I get mostly ones that are younger. And how do you treat your seniors for diabetes? Because they don't want to spend their whole day flushing the toilet at night or night.
That's for sure. And again, as we were talking about in high blood pressure, I generally go fairly slow. The reason is a wise man once told me, and it might have been you back in the day, we've known each other for so long, that if you have a high blood sugar and you're diabetic, it'll kill you eventually. But if you have a low blood sugar, it can kill you today. So I really try to avoid medications that will drop the patient's blood sugars suddenly. And now we have a myriad of medications that we can select, that we can add patients that all attack the blood sugar in a different way, but without dropping the patient's blood sugar too low. I'm still a fan of metformin. I'm still a fan of pioglitazone because, again, these are more gentle drugs that generally do not cause the patient to get hypoglycemic. Also, they're generic and inexpensive. And we haven't touched on the economics of medicine yet, but a lot of my patients are on a fixed income, and they really don't want to spend a lot of money on medications, and there's so many good drugs out there that are generic that we could still use. I know there's a lot of new medications that are not generic and are pretty expensive. They work great, but a lot of my patients are not interested in them, and because they even though I give them samples, they'll say, I found out I can't get a deal on this drug. It's too expensive. I can't take it. So that kind of sets you back when you have a plan on how you want to treat the patient. The patient says, I can't afford this medication. So I go the reverse route. I try to get them on generic, inexpensive stuff first, and then add a bit more expensive stuff if I really need to down the line.
Okay, well, that makes sense to me. So your metformin, your pioglitazone, and would you throw in a third? I'm just worried about you and your geriatrics and insulin, so I'm just trying to see what you say about insulin. That's a little tough.
Insulin is tough, and I'm blessed in that most of my patients don't like needles. So I don't want them to take insulin if they don't need to, because insulin, as you know, is atherogenic. It causes plaque in arteries. And as a result, I want to keep my patients off insulin if at all possible. So I will put my patients up to five different diabetic medications before I have to go to insulin. Now, over a period of time, if you're a type 2 diabetic for 25 or 30 years, very often you'll, at the end of their lives, the patients will get like a type 1 diabetic because the pancreas is burned out and the pancreas can no longer make insulin. So they have insulin resistance and they have an inability to make insulin. So those patients have to go on insulin, unfortunately. But thank God there are very, very few of those that need that. Almost all the patients can be treated with oral medication at a reasonable cost and keeping their blood sugar down. A lot of it is how does the patient and the families buy into it. I have to tell you, these new monitors that monitor your blood sugars for 2 weeks using a smartphone, it's been a great device, even for my elderly patients, because a lot of them know how to use a smartphone. And they can scan their blood sugar and instantly know what it is. They kind of like it. They think it's fun. And anything that gives the physician more information to try to help the patient control their diabetes is always a good thing.
Fantastic. So I think you're talking about Freestyle and Dexcoms and those kind of things that people can just take their phone out and pop it next to it or look at their sensor and see exactly where their sugar is. And it cuts down on those low sugars, too, which is very helpful.
It is. As long as the patient buys in and wants to be part of it, because that's the biggest thing, is convincing the patient that this is a very personal disease. And my dentist used to have a sign over her chair when you laid back, and the sign read, "If you ignore your teeth, they'll all go away." And in medicine, it's the same thing. If you ignore your health, it'll go away. So if the patients buy into it, they're checking their blood sugar, they're checking their blood pressure at home, they give the doctor information, and information is power for the patient and the doctor. So the more you know, the better it is.
So can you, I just want to see if you complain like I do. Do you get hit with pre-certification much in your senior citizens?
Oh, boy, yeah.
Can you tell everybody what pre-certification is?
Well, a pre-cert is generally an insurance thing where a doctor says, like for example, many senior citizens have shoulder problems. If you live long enough, everybody gets shoulder issues, and you get rotator cuff issues and that kind of a thing. And very often the doctor will want to order an MRI of your shoulder to see where the problem is and whether or not a cortisone shot could help or if the patient actually needs surgery. And very often the insurance company will not allow the patient to have the MRI. You have to get what they call a pre-certification. You have to explain to them in detail why the patient needs it. And very often the insurance company will deny it and say, well, you haven't gotten plain x-rays yet. So then you got to go out and order a set of useless shoulder x-rays. And then the patient gets that, and then you have to submit them to the insurance company. And this is in my practice, we have a girl who's a full-time job just doing pre-certs. It pre-certs for medication. Certain medications are approved. Certain medications are not approved. Why? Well, did you try this drug first or that drug first? And now the drug company or the insurance company is telling the doctor how to practice medicine. You got to use this drug first or that drug first, or else we're not going to pay. It's extremely annoying, and it's frustrating for the patients because they want to kind of get on with it. If I need an MRI, I want to be able to go to the x-ray center and get it. And I wish it was that easy, but it's not. And we have to jump through the bureaucratic hoops. So that's why we have people in our office that are doing that all day long.
So it's a waste of time, very frustrating. And the people on the other side don't know what they're doing. They're just following a little algorithm. So no conceptualization, and it takes your time, and it's taking your money. And the answer is that your practice costs go up. And I don't know if you know this or not, but Medicare indicated in 2 years they're reducing physician fees further. So welcome to medicine in 2024.
I think that's one of the reasons that physicians, very often you'll see that doctors who are in private practice end up working for Penn, Virtua, Cooper. You'll see that, why would they take a job with the corporation? It's because Medicare has not increased their rates. They're the lowest payer, which one of the reasons that geriatrics is not a very popular specialty. The doctors, we make the least amount of money. But that aside, if your reimbursement is flat for 10 years, you know that your health insurance premiums are going to go up, your staff salaries are going to go up, the rent's going to go up, and as a result, the doctors are going to make less money. And eventually what happens, they kind of give up the ghost, and they turn their practice over to the hospital, and the hospital runs it for them and gives them a salary, and they work in the office. So you're having more and more physicians nowadays employed by another entity as opposed to staying in private practice.
Yes. So there was a recent publication that reported that swapping salt out for the salt substitute potassium chloride lowers blood pressure and thereby risk of heart attack, stroke, and cardiovascular disease. So I'm just curious, how do your, with this, these phenomenal results of using potassium chloride instead of sodium chloride, basically they summed up 21 published studies. So I'm curious, does your geriatric group at all respond to, say, a salt substitute as opposed to sodium chloride for health reasons, or have you not seen this, or how's it playing out in the geriatric side?
Well, again, most of my senior citizens don't add any salt to their food at all. Pepper, they use liberally. I encourage patients to use a lot of pepper, but they either put the salt shaker away, and most of them don't even use the salt substitute. They get by perfectly fine with just pepper, that kind of a thing. So most of my patients have bought into the low-salt routine. And as a result, after a while, you kind of get used to it. You know, it's one of those things that when people gave up regular soda, went to diet soda back in the day, it took them a while to get adjusted to it, but after a while, they got adjusted to it. And, you know, now people are drinking more and more water as opposed to drinking soda, which is, I think, is a very healthy thing. People need to drink, especially seniors, they need to drink water and they need to drink coffee are two of the big thing beverages that I propose. But after a while, you just kind of get used to it. And not having a salt shaker on the table is something that they've just gotten used to over time. It helps their blood pressure. It helps the swelling in their feet. It helps their breathing. It helps them on many, many levels. So we've been a very, very big low-salt group for a long, long time.
Fantastic. So bringing up that, I mean, the temperature has been hot recently, and you're talking about drinking water. And the question is heat stroke in the seniors. Like you said, one of the best things to do is to put a senior in with other family members so that someone can check in. And a lot of these gals who are, you know, live alone, the reason I say gals because they seem to outdistance us guys, they don't get enough water when the temperature gets to 90 degrees and they don't have their air conditioner on. They're trying to save a buck. Have you seen any heat stroke or heat disease so far this year in your practice?
We've had a couple of patients that have ended up in the hospital that way. Unfortunately, a lot of them are in nursing homes. So, for example, you know, in nursing homes, very often the nurses are so busy passing out medications and stuff that they're really not checking on the patients to see did they drink their water in their water pitcher today. And what will happen is that the patient will be, you know, have an altered mental status. They'll get really, really lethargic, and they think that the patient's having a urinary tract infection. They'll ship the patient to the ER or the hospital, and we'll admit the patient. We find out that they're dehydrated because they haven't been drinking enough water. So we have a few of these every summer. We have a bunch. But it's more of a situation where the patient is not recognizing that they need to drink the water, or the nurses or the family do not recognize it. And, it's, again, this is one of these things. The more help you have when you're a senior, the better your outcome is going to be. People who live alone by themselves, they're the most in the most danger.
So let me just push forward a little bit. I opened up a little bit on this article on depression. How about depression in the elderly? A problem? Not a problem? How do you treat it if they have it? Depression.
Well, depression is really, really common in the elderly, and unfortunately, COVID made it a hell of a lot worse. My mother is 91 years old this September, and she was in an assisted living unit. And for a year, she was locked in. We couldn't see her. So we would go to the parking lot and wave to her. She could come to the window. We could wave to her, and we would, you know, we love you, and chalk on the ground so she could see it from her window. But the idea is a lot of people were isolated during the pandemic, and depression was on the increase across all age groups, but especially the elderly. A lot of the elderly patients, their children couldn't visit them. A lot of the elderly patients, their friends died of COVID, and they became more and more isolated. Depression became a huge thing and has maintained such. And it's depression on all across the spectrum. I have a patient of mine in assisted living who was Jewish, and she passed away from COVID in the facility. Her daughter lived in Florida. And because the patient had to be buried within 24 hours because of the travel restrictions with COVID, she couldn't be with her mother when they buried her. And she went into depression. I mean, there's all kinds of depression that's going on for both the patients and their family members because of the increased isolation during the COVID pandemic. All with the best intentions. We want to protect the elderly, and we want to make sure that they don't get sick. But at the same time, if they're isolated and they don't interact with other human beings, it's terrible for them.
So Bob, what's your favorite antidepressive? Because they can be very efficacious. How do you play your antidepressant RX?
I'm a very big senior citizen sertraline guy because
okay.
The dosage is very, very flexible. You can start really low, and you can gradually increase the dose. It's generic. It's cheap. So it is effective. It works pretty good. You just have to give it time. So, again, educating the patient, listen, this is not going to turn around tomorrow. But every month, I'll have you back in next month. If we need to increase the dose, we'll do it then, that kind of thing. And you go slow, and the patients will have a positive result.
Okay. So Bob, you're a geriatric physician. You've got a big group. Can you kind of like go again how many doctors you have helping out the geriatric population?
We have five physicians that go everywhere. Again, we go to nursing homes, hospitals, rehabilitation centers, that kind of thing. We have 12 nurse practitioners. And believe it or not, you know, one of the biggest problems we have is recruitment. We're trying desperately to hire more staff because there's a lot more senior citizens out there that could use help. And it's really hard for us to recruit doctors into the practice. It's New Jersey's a tough sell for a lot of young doctors coming out of training.
So you've got lots of help. Now, so what's your daily day? You start early and go to bed late. What's your daily day look like?
Unfortunately, that's true. I go into the office and start seeing patients early in the morning. And as we're running through the patients, I'll get on the phone. I'll be talking to the emergency room about another patient. I'll be talking to one of my nurse practitioners on a group text. We'll be discussing, you know, issues with the staff. And then I'll be on the phone doing a telehealth visit in between patient A and patient B. If I can straighten something out real, real fast, I'll be able to do that. Otherwise, the telehealth visits will be set at 6 o'clock when the staff go home. So that's when the phone calls start. Now, I won't call anybody after 9 p.m. for a telehealth because people go to bed early. But, you know, you have to allot time for all this, and that's the problem with being a geriatrician. It's a day that starts early and kind of ends late.
So Bob, you have to tell everybody, where's your office? How do people get in touch with you? What's your phone number? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people need your help, even though you're loaded already. So can you give us how to get a hold of Bob Merrow and his group?
You can get a hold of me. The office address is 701 Cooper Road in Voorhees. And the phone number is 856-429-2224. And the email address, I'll give you my own personal email address. It's the world's easiest email, MarrowMD, MaroMD, @AOL.com.
Bob, thank you for hopping on. It's been fantastic. Over and out, Inside Medicine. We'll be back next week with two special guests. Over and out. Thank you. Joe Fallon signing off.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.